Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Experience the unconventional,
evening, boss.
The unpredictable,
what's happening?
And the completely unorthodox,
exactly.
With rule-free Ian Lee, the late-night alternative with Ian Lee.
I've got no internet for the last 4 days.
On Talk Radio.
You've got 40 days to take as much money as you like, starting from now.
Mr. That's Bruce Forsyth, here we go, here we go. He's doing it.
Two, keep going, you're doing... But you've done it!
Yes, man. I've just spent the last 4 minutes with my guest, who's an American. I think that would be fair to say.
It would be quite fair to say.
It would be fair to say that Ken Womack is an American, explaining Brexit and Bruce Forsyth. that song, Bruce Forsyth, I'm in charge, produced by George Martin, which is what Ken is here for. But I'm trying to think who your Bruce Forsyth would be. An age-old entertainer that's been around forever and still draws a crowd. Who would that be in America?
I'm not sure, but he's kind of that vintage where he's a personality, right?
Yeah. And a proper old-fashioned song and dance kind of guy. Hey, Catherine, is everything all right?
What?
Okay, why are you whispering? You know that we can still hear you. Ken thinks he's come on a really slick British radio show. Okay, fine. He's not noticed anything. Let's get the names of the books out. You've written two volumes on Sir to you, George Martin. Sound Pictures is the first volume. I'm just looking. No, that's the second volume. 66 to 2016. And Maximum Volume, 26 to 66. Why George Martin?
Well, quite simply, I wanted to study the person for whom the Beatles imagined all these wonderful songs, and he was their primary audience, yeah. The guy who got to hear them first, second, perhaps third at worst. He was the fellow to whom they would present these amazing songs. Yeah. What was that like? And that was the mission of the books, was to try to understand that.
And the Beatles obviously play a huge part. And we're not just going to talk about the Beatles, because it's very easy to ignore what happened before the Beatles and after the Beatles. There was an amazing amount of stuff he was doing either side of the Beatles.
Well, to paraphrase a Beatles movie, they loom large in his legend.
They do a little bit. But he is, I would say, the one person that can legitimately be called the fifth Beatle.
I think so. And, to be very truthful, and it's late night radio, so I can do that, right?
Mm.
Okay, so here it comes.
Honesty is what we
want. I mean, there were times when he was the second or third Beatle.
Yeah.
Given his enthusiasm and passion for whatever project they were working on, and simultaneously, perhaps, the distance that some of the other band members were putting between them and certain projects. So he was integral to just about everything they did.
He is, I never met him. I've met his son. Giles Martin, isn't it? Yes.
Correct.
Yeah, I've met
the
Giles,
youngest.
Who's delightful and charming. And how weird that he is carrying on his dad's Beatles connection with the same, almost the same kind of skills that his dad had. Was Giles with him as a boy watching him do Beatles stuff?
Well, Giles was born in October 1969,
right.
And by then the Beatles had decided privately to divorce.
Yeah.
So Giles misses the entire phenomenology of the band. But having said that, he was there with his father through the entirety of this kind of Beatles return that occurred slowly. I mean, they were always popular. Yeah. There's no doubt about that. But this kind of reformatting that's sort of endless, right?
Yeah.
The 1987 CDs, the 2009 remasters, and now these remixes. Bringing to life the joke that Tommy Lee Jones makes in Men in Black that he's just going to keep buying the White Album for the rest of his life.
Well, we're going to buy... I've got an order in for the box set of the White Album in November.
That's right. You're buying it now. Nope. So it's all very true. I don't think Giles intended to do this, but it was quite a natural production offshoot for him and an opportunity to carry on a great legacy, which he has done, I think, to a T.
Oh, incredibly so. How easy was it to find out about George Martin stuff that wasn't Beatles related?
Quite difficult.
Yeah.
You know, so many of the witnesses, and this is my fault for starting the project so late, had passed on.
Yeah, yeah.
George himself, when I began working on this, was deaf and not feeling so well. I mean, he had several long-running illnesses. So putting it together was quite difficult. You know, the Beatles material is out there. I did manage to find a few new nuggets here and there to pepper throughout that story. Pepper.
Well done. Well
pun intended.
Done. Excellent stuff.
Thank you very much. But beyond that...
I was desperately trying to think of another Beatles pun I could throw in there, and I failed miserably.
Well, we will come together on those later.
Man. I wish I had my revolver with me. That's a bit mean. I'm going to shoot you.
Yeah, don't get violent. This is not that kind of show.
No.
This is the opposite of those kinds of shows.
Exactly. Well done. You've done your homework.
Thank you.
So did you get to speak to him?
I did not.
No.
I immediately wrote to him once I had the contract, and his wonderful agent Adam wrote me back and said, George is delighted, you know, that folks are working on projects like this, but he won't be available.
Okay.
And of course, I knew he wouldn't.
Yeah.
Again, but it was nice to reach out to him.
Okay. Well, you got kind of a blessing from him.
Sure.
Then.
Although it's, you know, it's not an authorized biography.
No.
And that's such a tainted, tangled phrase, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it used to mean something in like the 60s and 70s. Yeah. It's the authorized biography.
Now it means all the drugs and sex have been cut out.
Right, right. Nobody wants that book.
No. I want the unauthorized Albert Goldman book to spill the dirt. One of my favorite George Martin clips ever is he did a wonderful series, I guess in the late 90s for the BBC, about music. And he interviewed people like Billy Joel. And there's a great bit where I'm a huge Beach Boys fan. And he sat with Brian Wilson at the mixing desk. And they're listening to the master tapes of God Only Knows. And George goes, well, I've always wished I could have produced this. And he starts playing around with it and just, you know, adding some of this and taking some of that. And Brian Wilson sits there and goes, oh, my God, that's better than what I did. And it's just such a beautiful... beautiful moment. And the thing about George Martin is he's a proper old-fashioned gentleman, isn't he? And the truth is he's very gentle, very polite, very, very well-mannered. Is that what you got from the people that you spoke to?
I think that's largely true. Of course, you know, George's life was the story of social climbing in a lot of ways. You know, he was born very humble origins, the most humble of all the Beatles, quite frankly.
Yeah.
It was only later when he self-consciously, as so many other veterans did, changed his accent to tailor himself to a new life, which he developed stupendously. But I think he really was that. I would often ask my interview subjects, you know, was there a time when George let you see behind the veneer? And really only two or three times did anybody say, yeah, he kind of lost it.
Oh, wow. Really?
Sure. But he rarely did.
Yeah, yeah.
And it had less to do with the fact that he didn't have a bad temper. I think he had the same temper we all do.
Yeah.
But rather that he was a great politician, which is how he would negotiate the ebb and tide of the Beatles' waves of furor over those very tendentious but wonderful years. And it was that great political sense that he had that made him so effective inside that political calculus.
How did it? Well, we lost, of course, Jeff Emerick last week or the week before. You know, 72, I think he was.
I think he was 74.
74.
No, you're absolutely right. He was 72.
Okay.
He would have been 73 in December. He was coming to our university next month, and he'd been very excited.
This is in Jersey.
Right. He was. I'm dean at the Monmouth University,
in
the Wayne D. McMurray School of Humanities and Social Sciences, and Jeff was coming to sort of close out a symposium we're doing on the White Album.
Yeah.
And he was very excited to come in and be a part of, you know, college life and yeah. be a part of something that was intellectual. And it was
smoke a few reefers again, pretend it's the 60s, you know.
he was very excited, and it was a shame. It was something special, I think, we were creeping toward.
What was the relationship between Jeff Emerick and George Martin?
Well, it was essential. George was always the right guy for the Beatles. And like Brian Epstein and like the Beatles themselves, they all came at the industry in a kind of sideways manner. Yeah. You know, Brian Epstein wasn't really a manager. He failed at everything he'd ever done. And he decides he's going to be a manager. So he's coming at the industry. The Beatles, well, they're from Liverpool. That's not going to work.
Yeah.
And George Martin is faking it as a producer.
Yeah.
And they're all hurtling toward this industry, and they disrupt it. And Jeff really fit that mold, too.
Right.
He gets his job. I guess his dad wanted him out of the house. He wrote a letter to EMI and said, my son could be an engineer. And Jeff was 15 or something. And they said, well, I guess he could. We'll pay him no money. And
incredible.
Yeah. And so Jeff got into the business in a sort of sideways fashion, too. He was from Crouch End.
Oh, I lived in Crouch End.
Well, there
for a
you
long
go.
Time.
So
yeah,
you
know,
kind
well.
Of know the Emerick, you know, firmament, yeah. I suppose. In any event, they were great together. George had gotten to the point where he needed an engineer with a little bit more vision, because George was no techie. You know, he didn't know how to. He could work
right.
the faders, but he was more of a classical guy.
Okay.
You know, he would say, I'm very 12 inch. You know, he was more 78
yeah.
than 45 RPM. And
yeah.
so Jeff, being a younger guy and a guy who knew how his way around a soldering iron, I guess,
yeah.
was perfect for him. And that's when it timed out perfectly. It was Revolver and Sergeant Pepper.
And would Jeff been one of. I love the fact that when the Beatles started recording at EMI, the engineers still wore the white lab coats, and it was still a very scientific, you know, it was a process that you had
it's
to go
quite
through.
Quite formal, yeah. You had an apprenticeship. You would be, you know, you'd come in as a lacquer cutter and then a tape operator,
yeah.
and, you know, maybe then you'd be second engineer and then finally first engineer and then a full-fledged producer. There was this whole kind of apprenticeship. There's a famous story in 1940. Winston Churchill went to Abbey Road, which, of course, was then EMI Studios. They were making propaganda recordings for the war.
Of course.
And there's old Winnie, and he sees all these white-coated, you know, fellows, and he's like, wow, have I died? Am I in the hospital? You know, he thought it was ridiculous.
Well, it is to have such a scientific, you know, now we consider music an art form. Of course, it wasn't an art form. And you're right. George Martin was integral to the Beatles. The few times he took his hands off of the reins of the Beatles, it suffered. I'm thinking of the whole Let It Be album, which I like, but it doesn't sound right. It's muddy, and it doesn't, you know, Phil Spector's hands over it. And also things like the string arrangements on She's Leaving Home, which was Mike Leander, I think, which is this big, huge kind of, I think, over-the-top, slightly offensive kind of orchestral backing, whereas with George, with the Beatles, was kind of small and tiny, these wonderful scorings that he did. He made, you know, his ability to interpret ridiculous ideas like John Lennon saying, I want 10,000 chanting monks, or whatever it was. His ability to translate that is genius, is as much a genius as Lennon and McCartney's songwriting skills, I think, anyway.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, George would disappear as a producer into the recording.
Mm.
So, in other words, it wouldn't have any kind of trademark feel, like you said, Phil Spector with his wall of sound, or contemporarily Jeff Lynne, right?
Oh.
Every Jeff Lynne recording. And some of them are wonderful, some of them are not, but they all have a certain sheen to them.
They sound like Jeff Lynne.
They do. They sound like Jeff Lynne. And, you know, that's a shame when you're listening to Tom Petty. You really want to hear Tom Petty.
Yeah. When you hear Free as a Bird, I don't want to hear an ELO song. This is what I'm hearing.
Right.
Know?
And it's not even good mid or early ELO.
No.
It's late period Shine a Little Love, Don't
yeah.
Bring Me Down.
Yeah, yeah.
That's bringing you down. ELO. And, you know, George would disappear into a recording, and that was his magic,
yeah.
was his superpowers, being able to understand what they wanted and then to disappear into that.
The worst things the Beatles ever did, mainly in their solo career, was pair up with Phil Spector and Jeff Lynne. You just want to hear those John albums without the 25 drummers and 16 saxophones. We'll take a quick break. I've got Ken Womack here, who's written a two-volume biography of George Martin. I'm going to tweet the links in a little bit, guys. All the usual places. We'll give out his website as well. If you've got any questions, we won't be talking solely about the Beatles. I know that some people, get this, Ken, some people don't like the Beatles.
No, there's no such thing. It's like disliking children or Christmas
or
something.
You can't do it, but there are some people who listen to this show who hate the Beatles.
Right now, they're listening.
They'll have switched off. 0344 499 1000. This is Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Dial up some dialogue.
Talk Radio. We'll get you talking.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Excuse me.
Oh, Dad.
Hello, I'm Martin Kellner.
And I'm his daughter, Ruthie.
We do a podcast. It's called Ruthie, Me and My Dad.
In which I tell him how he's wrong about most things.
And I explain to her who the Bee Gees were. It's on Acast and Apple Podcasts.
And all your favourite podcast providers.
It's a unique generation gap conversation between a baby boomer dad
and his Generation Z daughter.
That's Ruthie, Me and My Dad. Brand new episodes every Thursday.
Unmissable late night radio with the original king of unconventional conversation.
Make contact with Ian Lee.
The late night alternative with Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Two volumes about George Martin. Some of you will be going, oh my God. And some of you will be salivating hard at the prospect. Maximum Volume and Sound Pictures by Ken Womack. We're going to tweet the links. Last Beatles thing, and then we're going to talk about other stuff. Ken, I was just saying that up until Revolver, that in America, listening to the Beatles was a different experience than it was for people in the UK, because you had different albums, because it was Capitol, wasn't it? Thought, hey, instead of putting 12, 14 songs on an album, if we put 10 or 11, then we can save some of these other songs and put them out as EP. So they were different albums. And this is my theory that no one else has ever picked up on. When Brian Wilson talks about how his inspiration for Pet Sounds was Rubber Soul, he was listening to a different Rubber Soul. He wasn't listening to the Rubber Soul that I would know. He was listening to the American Rubber Soul, which is kind of a folk album. It's an acoustic album. And you could see how that would shape Pet Sounds and be a driving force for him. Because the American version is more of a kind of concept in sound, I think.
No, absolutely. And I, frankly, was one of the people who was duped by this.
Right.
You know, when I would go to the record stores in the late 70s and I would look into the bins, these are the records I bought. Yeah. So for many years, as a young guy, I thought, well, that's what Rubber Soul was. That's what Revolver was. And you're absolutely right. The album that, that the Beach Boys and Brian in particular was consuming was very different.
Yeah.
And it had a completely different tonality. And damn Capitol, by the way, we can say that. They're no longer an EMI subsidiary. For manipulating their sound in that way.
Yeah.
It was only with Sgt. Pepper that they had the sort of cultural or, I suppose, financial power to say, put these albums out the right way.
And it seems incredible now that the record label would have that much influence. They're not just for one or two. For the first five, six albums, however many it is, they're going to go, no, okay, you want to make an artistic statement, but we're the money men. We're going to take bits and pieces. Let's move away from the Beatles, because I can. Otherwise, we're here until 1 o'clock.
But the hard salivators will, no?
they'll still be salivating
okay,
hard.
Okay, good.
They turns out they salivate hard, whatever. give us George Martin's background, because you're right. He kind of changed himself to fit in. And the later George Martin was a very tall, very slim, very elegant.
Well, he's always tall.
He's always tall. But we would consider him to be a very posh English gentleman. But that wasn't how he started, was he?
No. He was born in North London very impoverished surroundings. Mm. He and his sister fought over a single gas jet around the fireplace.
Wow.
They had no electricity, no running water. They were born into the Depression. His father was a master carpenter, which wasn't a great time to be a master carpenter, of course, because nobody was doing any fine woodwork to speak of. His mother would hustle doing knitting on the side, and later they took in orphans, many, many orphans.
Wow.
And by the time George gets to the war years, he just wants out of that household.
Yeah.
There were so many orphans living there. They were getting stipends from the government. George could not wait to get to war, but he got to a good war because by then, it's 1944, it was essentially over.
Yeah.
And during the war, he was a man of natural leadership ability, and he was sent to officers' training. And while there, he would listen to the posh cut-glass voices of the well-bred officers in training. And they would have these marvelous meals not far from here in Greenwich.
Mm.
And they would George would notice that they knew how to use the right hand for the knife and fork, and they put their napkin in their lap, and they sounded great. And he thought, that's what I'm going to be.
Isn't that interesting?
But he was hardly the only one.
No, of course. But okay, well, then how did he make the transition from that into working in music? What was his...
A single guy. Now, George was always a pretty good scratch pianist. But he caught the attention of a fellow named Sidney Harrison, and George called him his fairy godfather. And Sidney is probably why we have the great sound of the Beatles. I know we weren't going to talk about them anymore, but there it is.
It's impossible not to keep nodding.
It is, yes. I think the hard salivators will be excited about Sidney Harrison.
Yeah.
So Sidney is very influential. Mm. He's a professor at the Guildhall School. And he carries on this correspondence during the war with George. He helps him work out how to do notation and those sorts of things because George is not good at it.
As in musical notation.
That's right.
He taught himself then, did he, with the help of this?
With the help of Sidney Harrison. After the war, George has no plans, and Sidney says, well, you should go to the Guildhall School. And George rightly says, I'll never get in.
Yeah.
Are you kidding? I'll have to have an audition. And Sidney says, no, you won't. And sure enough, George goes to the Guildhall School, and Sidney strikes one more time with his fairy godfather-ish wand.
Yeah.
In 1950, when George finishes his coursework, again, no prospects, Sidney says there's a job for you if you want to go interview with a guy named Oscar Preuss. And Preuss was head of the third label at EMI, Parlophone.
Parlophone.
And he needed an assistant. The job was killing him. Parlophone was in desperate, dire straits.
Yeah.
So George put on his Fleet Air Arm greatcoat and rode across London and walked right into Judy Lockhart Smith, who would figure very largely in his story later. And Oscar said, you're on.
Wow. And how old would he have been at that point?
He would have been 1950. He is 24.
Okay. So a young man.
12 years later, when he meets the Beatles, there they are again. He is 36, and they think he's the oldest man in the world. But of course, by then, he is posh.
Well, he is posh by then. And by then, he's learned so many of the skills. This is why I think the pairing of the Beatles with him was so fortuitous. Everything was aligning. Because when Lennon says, I want 10,000 chanting monks, George Martin had a decade of doing ridiculous, silly, dumb comedy records.
That's right.
That were amazing. That weren't just, okay, well, we're going to record an orchestra or we're going to record a jazz group. It's like Peter Sellers creating, or Spike Milligan or Michael Bentine, creating these ridiculous worlds and kind of saying to him, right, well can you put me in this betting shop? Can you put me in this, you know, can you create these environments?
And that was George's favorite thing to do.
Really?
He saw the studio as this kind of magic workshop. He was pushing for that almost from the beginning of his work there, even before he was head of the label. He really wanted to create ambiance in the studio. Mm. And of course, the Beatles have great ambiance, yeah. right? Rocky Raccoon, you feel like you're in a saloon,
yeah, yeah.
that you're going to get shot.
Yeah.
You know, it's all very, very real. And George was fantastic at creating setting. And it was, in many ways, his superpower.
How did he get paired up then with the comedians? These making these comedy records?
Purely out of necessity.
Yeah.
When George takes over in the mid-1950s and Preuss is retiring, in fact, Preuss dies within a year after retiring.
Of course he does. It's often the way.
It is. It's yeah.
Never stop moving.
It's a cliche, isn't yeah. it? So in any event, but they had become great friends, and Preuss was very instrumental in making sure George was his successor at Labelhead. But when he became Labelhead, Preuss said, look, you know, they want to mothball this label. Mm. You better get it together. And George was looking for a way to save Parlophone, and it was comedy that did it.
Mm. Who was the first? Who was the first one he would have worked? Was it? Wouldn't have been Sellers, would it?
Peter Sellers? No. Sellers came along pretty quickly, but he was doing a lot of live mobile work.
Right. Okay.
And so he would, he'd go out and do Beyond the Fringe, right, or things like that. And there were several different. Several different groups and teams he worked with, and he really brought that to life. And yeah. it was kind of a phenomenon, right? Here he is, the live hookup, the live recording, and now it's in your home. Parlophone yeah. presents.
Oh, yeah. Nowadays, you can go and record a live concert with a tiny little box. I'm imagining then it was a big old rig that would take a team to assemble.
Sure, they had a mobile unit. Now, by the time he starts to do that with Seccomann Wise and those guys, it's become a lot more professional. When he starts, true story, in 1950, one of his first assignments was to go up to Scotland and yeah. record these Dixieland jazz bands who would record in the back of a church or a school.
Yeah.
George would drive up in the EMI van, beautiful. And they didn't have tape. So what they would do is they'd have a microphone, and you know it would be rigged out to the van, and George would cut straight to disc.
No!
Yes.
Oh, man!
And so here's how it would work. They'd have a stack of discs at the end of the day. It'd be like a Saturday or something.
Yeah.
All these bands would line up and record their best song. George wouldn't even listen to them. He'd get in the van and he'd drive all the way back to London. They'd play the disc, see if any of them were any good, and that's what was released. No wonder they were in trouble.
That is incredible. And again, I'm going to say the B word. Again, that if he's doing it like that, that explains how, you know, the first Beatles album was recorded in like a day or something, 12 hours or
that's
something,
right.
wasn't it? So many of those, sometimes in a three-hour session, they'd record to, you know, an A side and a B side. Because I guess if he's doing what you were saying he was doing, you've got to be quick. You can't mess around. It's like, we've got this time, we've got to do this now. Obviously, that changed towards the end of the 60s when maybe people started spending too much time on records. You know, and now it takes like 2 years, 3 years to record an album. Come on, man, it's 12 songs. Just go in and do it. but then that speed was a necessity.
Oh, it absolutely was. And of course, by the time Beatlemania sets and arises, rather, in yeah. both the UK and the US, he has so little time with them. When they get together, they yeah. got to do it. There's a session in mid-1965. In the same day, they record I'm Down, I've Just Seen a Face, and Yesterday, Save for the Strings, yeah. all in one day.
Yeah,
it's amazing what they'll churn through.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they were that good.
Yeah.
So they were able to do it.
Funny you mentioned Yesterday. It's one of my least favorite Beatles songs. And I've just recorded a podcast which discusses Beatles albums and solo albums. And I picked Give My Regards to Broad Street, but kind of for a perverse reason. But also, I think the version of Yesterday on there is actually nicer. I prefer the brass. Huh. I know, controversial.
Wow.
But that was produced by...
I wonder what the Hard Salivators are thinking now.
that's going to kick off. But that whole album was produced by George Martin. And after... What I find interesting about the Beatles is after... When they split, they kind of turned their back on what they had done before. They turned their back for a bit on EMI and on Abbey Road. Certainly on George Martin, and John Lennon would later go on and slag him off.
Over and over.
Oh, yeah. Or, you know, and say that he ruined Strawberry Fields and that he wanted to re-record all of those songs because Martin ruined it. I suspected John lived a few years more he would have taken that bat.
He's a guy who never gets to be 41. He barely gets to be 40.
Yeah.
But he did, you know, he made up with George in December 1979.
Oh, did he?
George came over. He was in New York. John said, come over. Yoko, as George later remembered, made herself scarce.
Yeah.
And they had a great evening together. And that was the evening where he said he'd re-record everything.
Oh.
And George was offended. But then he thought, you know what? That's just John.
Yeah, yeah.
The world can never be as great as it is in his imagination.
Mm.
And I think you're absolutely right. He would have come around on that.
Of course
he also apologized during that dinner. And he said, look, when I said all those things, I was whacked out of my mind. And, you know, George had kind of figured that.
Yeah.
And they had a great last evening together.
But I think the McCartney's best solo stuff is with George Martin.
It's Tug of War.
Tug of War, Pipes of Peace,
but
Live
Tug
and
of
Let
War
Die.
Is the, you know, is the best record.
Yeah.
By a mile.
Yeah, definitely.
It's
with George Martin. Was he reluctant to get back when Paul kind of clicked his fingers, or was he eager
Not at
to
all.
Dive in?
No, and you know, I do have a feeling, and I suggest this in Sound Pictures, I do believe he had a lot to do with Wings breaking up.
Right.
George thought Paul was better than that band.
Yeah.
Linda would have agreed. She thought he was always playing with musicians who weren't quite up to his caliber. He has a great road band now that probably is far more in line. I think Linda would be happy with this group. But he, you know, George felt like Paul was underplaying his hand and helped him along.
Mm.
The reason why they worked well, at least initially, so well together, is George was probably the one guy who could say to Paul and the whole world, hey, that's a bad idea.
This is the thing that is lacking in Paul McCartney's solo career, is someone saying, you can do better than that.
Sure, and...
And Martin could do it.
Sure. And Lennon McCartney not working together, that works for a little bit. There are some great songs they come out of the gate with. But, of course, they're closer to the end of the Beatles.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them were Beatles leftovers that didn't get used.
Right. Maybe I'm Amazed is essentially a Beatles song. Imagine.
Yeah.
You know, these songs, Instant Karma.
Yeah.
And Ringo and the same thing with All Things Must Pass. But, you know, the longer they get away from each other, they needed that person who could edit them and tell them, you know, what's what in a brutal but still loving fashion.
After the Beatles, excuse me, Martin had...
We all need that kind of person.
We do. I've got Kath. She tells me when I'm doing badly. She tells me quite often. There we go.
That was a thumbs down. She gave a thumbs down. The hard salivators can't see this at home, but there was a thumbs down.
Well, I've got to say, Ken, it's been nice meeting you, but the boss has spoken. Get out.
Well, I thought that was for you.
I get
to stay, right?
You get to stay. I get to go.
I got the thumbs up.
But he did produce some great stuff. We had Jimmy Webb on the show. He produced Mirage, I think, was the album. Can't quite remember. Which is a lush album. And we said to Jimmy Webb, how did you feel about working with George? He says, do you know what? I was so proud, but I feel guilty because I was taking a lot of cocaine. And I wasn't, I didn't give George Martin the best that he deserved. And he felt that he'd let George, you know, 40 years later, he still felt he'd let George Martin down by not giving him what he deserved. He did do some great stuff after the Beatles, but nothing ever as big. There were hits and there were some great albums. How did he feel, do you think, about his career, sort of 1970 onwards, the musical career? Did he feel disappointed? Did he feel that the Beatles were kind of a weight around his neck that he couldn't shake off?
None of those things. You know, Giles, likes to say that George never looked back, and that's very true.
Wow, okay.
He just didn't do it.
Yeah.
He was so forward-thinking. He had... as we all do, a set of grievances that he would return to occasionally in his own psyche and get riled up about, but then he would push them back again. And many of them were with EMI, quite frankly. But he didn't look back. He was, like all of us, he's looking for that next great experience. And did it happen? Probably not. He understood the weight of the Beatles and how important they were.
Yeah.
And he spent much of the remainder of his life trying to, you know, make sure that legacy was protected and honored, and he did a damn good job of that. But having said that, you know, he was always looking for the next big thing. Did he find it? I don't know. I mean, he does some great work with America.
Yeah,
he helps
yeah.
them right their ship. As you said, he does some great work with Paul McCartney. I think he makes Jeff Beck's greatest album, Diamond Dust. But, you know, beyond that, he never returns to that lofty space, but neither do they.
No.
They truly were the sum of their parts, John, Paul, George, Ringo, and George.
Yeah.
And I think they're all diminished without each other. Even in their finest moments, there's always something sort of not there.
I wonder what Pete Best would say about George Martin. I miss Pete Best. I do think that Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr and Pete Best should try and reform the Beatles in some... They're the three remaining Beatles. Let's get those guys back together and do a tour.
I was talking to Ken Townsend recently. He gave my wife and I a lovely tour of the studio. And, you know, he was the manager for many, many years and just a great person and you know, a true pioneer in British, if not world recording.
Yeah.
And I was asking him about the first time he met them. And he starts to tell the story about, you know, fixing Paul's amp and all of this stuff in June 1962. But then he looked at us and he said, wow, you know, I'm one of the only people alive. Let's see, Paul's still alive and Pete is still alive.
Now that's it.
Yeah, that's kind of it. George Martin never had anything against Pete.
No.
You know, he just thought he wasn't up for recordings. He said, keep him as a live player. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, he's good looking. Why not?
And Jimmy Nicol. Let's get Jimmy Nicol in, the drummer that replaced Ringo for the Australian.
Oh, poor Jimmy. I think Jimmy's in South America now.
Jimmy's disappeared. There's a great book that came out about him.
Yeah,
my
friend
ago.
Jim Birkenstock wrote it.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, tell him I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a great read.
I'm sure he's listening now.
Oh, well,
he's a hard salivator.
I loved it.
I'll bring him back next time I come.
Oh, please do, because I'd love to get Jimmy Nicol on the show, but he's just disappeared, isn't he?
He's in South America. I think if this could be the show that brings him back.
Oh man, I want Jimmy Nicol on this show.
That's right. There's a quest worth striving for.
Ken, it's so nice to talk to you. How long did these are two very mighty tomes. How long did it take you to put these together?
About 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah. But, you know, like most of us Beatles people, I was thinking about it for most of my life.
Who's his name? And I know that you know him. His name's escaped me. We've had him on the show. The guy that...
Mark Lewison.
Thank you very much.
You're
indeed.
Welcome. Thank you. I couldn't watch you strain anymore.
Thank you. I went to his house, and I mean, your books are detailed, but Mark Lewison, that guy takes the piss is the phrase we have over here. Here's that book, which is the
it's a million words.
It's ridiculous. It's wonderful. But I read a great tweet about it. For those who don't know, he's writing three volumes. He'll never finish them. He said to me himself he doubts he'll finish them. He doesn't think he'll be around long enough.
Well, I took him to lunch last summer.
Yeah.
And Mark, if you're listening, you need to watch this.
He said to me.
He had like a giant steak and a beer.
Come on.
He needs to be on a strict vegetarian diet. A lot of people are counting on that book. Those books.
Those books. A friend of mine tweeted when that book came out, I'm on page 876, and I don't know much about the Beatles, but I know that Ringo's granddad stole a top hat once. And it's just, that's the detail it goes into.
Well, you know, Mark is, and you know this from knowing him, he's extraordinary.
Oh, he's
and
incredible.
And he is... I think he's courageous. In fact, he invented in many ways the kind of analysis that we do with his Great Beatles Recording Sessions book.
Those books are really common now where it's a day by day, this is what happened kind of thing. He was the first one to do it.
But his is the master class
in
it. And he did it very well. And frankly, without that, a lot of scholarship, the important kind of historical work that needed to be done, would probably have been lost at a certain point. All it took was one fire. In fact, at a certain point, not long after that, EMI almost went under.
Yeah.
And EMI Studios, Abbey Road, might have been a car park.
Yeah,
could have been. You know, what Mark did is absolutely heroic. He's one, you know, we all have our heroes, and he's one of mine.
Oh, he's a lovely man, but he ain't going to finish those books.
Well, he might if he goes vegan.
This. I'm just saying this so it gives him a kick up the ass.
So in other words, you're helping him.
Yeah.
This is coaching.
This is it. Ken, it's so nice to meet you. Ken Womack, Womack. There's loads of Beatles books, but the new books are the George Martin biographies, Maximum Volume and Sound Pictures. Now, you've got two versions. One, kind of the more weightier... kind of serious pictures, and one with the colours and the...
Would you like me to comment on that?
Yeah, go on. George Martin wearing shorts. I'd like comments on
that. Okay, yes. Now, when I first debuted that photo on Facebook, this one Facebook friend of mine said, why are you putting George naked? She thought he was wearing underwear. He's in the Caribbean.
Yes.
That's what you wear.
It's
volume two, sound pictures. The American versions have these flashy photos of George sitting at mixing desks.
Of course, the
British, you can see there, look like records. And actually the sides, the publisher designed them to look like those old Penguin books.
Yeah.
They're quite lovely.
Oh, because we can read.
But,
country.
You know, I think the hard salivators should buy all four. Two is not enough for them.
The thing is, you know there are completists that will actually do that. You know that there are people that will do that.
And I exist to
You're
help
preying
them.
Preying on their vulnerabilities.
I exist to help them do it.
So nice to meet you. You're back home tomorrow to suck up to Bruce Springsteen. Is that correct?
That's right. Back to the Jersey Shore, where we're planning a big White Album symposium. Hopefully the Hard Salivators will register and be there in November.
Can't wait for that White Album to come out. Yeah. Although, when are they
gonna... You should do like a live hookup from New Jersey.
Dude, I'm there.
Do you think Kathy would...
Yeah, we're there.
She's nodding.
Do you know what? We'll send her over there. She can be
Can Ian go? No. Oh, Ian can't go, but you can do the live hookup.
When are they going to... They...
I'll do the hookup. I'm the DJ. I'm
out of a job. He's just taught me how to
do
this. No,
no, you can engineer it.
I'll go out for dinner with your missus. You can do this. When are they going to do the 10-disc version of Revolver? That's all I'm interested in.
We all want that,
10
right?
Disc, I want a whole disc of Yellow Submarine outtakes.
And you know where Apple keeps going wrong?
Go on.
They misjudge us as the Hard Salivators. We would spend thousands of pounds.
Mate.
I would probably pay a monthly fee to have access to everything.
Oh, God.
Not to download, but just to listen to.
Totally.
Are you listening, Jeff Jones at Apple?
It's...
You would make money off of me. I would spend twice as much as Netflix
Access. The Dylan box sets, the last one was like £600-£700.
Yeah, they should quit making those available as box sets and just have us lease them every month. We're so used to it. We do our Netflix payments.
Come
we
on.
Do our Amazon
Ken,
Prime.
You must have some tasty bootlegs floating around. Send them over. Send me over your dodgy discs and we'll never hear any more of it again, I promise.
Okay, that's it.
So nice to meet you, Ken. Have a safe journey back tomorrow. Lovely to meet your wife as well. 0344-499-1000. The books, George Martin, Maximum Volume, Sound Pictures. Twitter, where should people go on Twitter to find you and harass
I'm,
you?
I'm at my name, Kenneth A. Womack.
There you go. You're seeing kennethwomack.com. Nice to meet you. This is the Late Night Alternative with me, Ian Lee, on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
A radio star is born.
You're going to love
Talk Radio.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.